Good afternoon. My name is Lynn, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Center for American Progress Power of the President conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there'll be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you, Ms. Anna Solner. You may begin your conference.
Thanks so much, Lynn, and thank you to everyone for joining us today. On behalf of the Center for American Progress, my name is Anna Solner. My cell phone number is 202-492-2967. If you have questions or follow-up after the call, you're free to give me a ring. Today, we're going to be talking about the power of the president and the options available to the administration using executive power. Despite all of the discussion of deadlock and stalemate, the U.S. Constitution and the laws of our nation grant the president significant authority to create and implement policy. Today, CAP has issued the report, The Power of the President, Recommendations to Advance Progressive Change, which proposes 30 executive actions the president can take to advance progressive change in areas of energy, the economy, healthcare, education, foreign policy, and national security. Joining us to discuss the recommendations is President and CEO of the Center for American Progress, John Podesta, who also served as Chief of Staff to President Clinton. Also joining us is Sarah Wortel, Executive Vice President at CAP and former Director of the National Economic Council under President Clinton, and Neera Tanden, Chief Operating Officer at CAP and former Senior Advisor to Secretary Sebelius for Health Reform at HHS. John?
Thank you, Anna, and thank you for joining us on the call. I just want to give a little context to this report. We wrote it because I think most of the conversation since the election has been about how President Obama adjusts to the new constellation on Capitol Hill. While that's an important conversation, it simply ignores the president's ability to use all the levers of his enormous power and authority to move the country forward, to create jobs, to keep people in their homes, to change the way we produce and consume energy, to better educate our children and young people, to prevent people from getting sick and helping them when they are ill. As a former White House Chief of Staff, in my view, one of the best ways for the Obama administration to achieve results of that nature in the short term is through its substantial executive authority to make and implement policy. As Anna noted, the Constitution and the laws of the United States give the president the ability and the responsibility to act as the chief executive, using authorities granted to all presidents, such as executive orders, rulemakings, agency management, convenings, and public-private partnerships. President Obama can demonstrate strength and resolve while proving to the American public that he can deliver on the kind of change that makes real change in their everyday lives. I've seen that strategy work before, of course. During my time in the White House, President Clinton used his extensive executive authority to make significant changes after Democrats lost control of the Congress in 1994. For example, he protected more land in the lower 48 states than any president since Teddy Roosevelt. He established the first national protections for Americans' medical privacy. He connected 95% of American schools to the Internet, or helped to do so. He enlisted the help of 20,000 businesses to move more than a million welfare recipients into the workforce through the Welfare to Work Partnership. He launched a national campaign against teen pregnancy that cut the teen pregnancy rate by 20%. He did that all, I would say, without the help of Congress. No one could doubt that President Bush also, when he took office in 2001, made extensive use of his executive authority. Sometimes I agreed with it, often I didn't, but he was able to move the policy agenda forward using executive authority. For example, early on, he issued a rule limiting federal funding of embryonic stem cell research. He denied later in his presidency a request from California to allow it to adopt stricter tailpipe emissions limits for greenhouse gas pollutants. He issued an executive order in his early days that was intended to implement, I guess I would say, undermine the Presidential Records Act, but that permitted him to block the release of records from former administrations. He took actually the symbolic step of unsigning the Rome Treaty that established the International Criminal Court, and he announced that he was abandoning the inspections protocol of the previously ratified Biological Weapons Convention. So this is not a really a partisan issue. It's an issue that confronts every president. Will you use those substantial authorities? And we tried to put down in this report some suggestions of the way the president could move his agenda forward using that extensive executive authority. We've outlined specific measurable actions the Obama administration can and we believe should take over the next 2 years, which Sarah and Nira will discuss. The fundamental point is that congressional gridlock doesn't mean that the federal government has to stand still. The public wants progress, not positioning, and the administration can use existing authorities to deliver real results and move the country forward. With that, let me turn it over to Sarah.
Thanks, John. So the report has over 30 examples, and what amongst them are examples of different kinds of authority of the president to make positive change. So one example that I wanted to showcase was the ability to use the purchasing power of the federal government. And we have on page 10 a suggestion that the president can both drive the reduction in carbon emissions and create demand for important new technologies by encouraging the Air Force to build solar arrays on the roof of Air Force hangars. An example using the president's power to convene and coordinate policy implementation, to elevate an objective to a national priority. The president can convene the business, labor, and government agencies together in an intensive dialogue around their shared interest in improving the competitiveness of U.S. products and services. There's another convening in here also around bringing together hunters and anglers to focus on fish and wildlife climate adaptation. In both cases, bringing people together and developing a shared agenda helps increase the prospects of moving policy forward through both executive and legislative authorities. An example using the market power of federal programs, we're at a unique moment right now where not only does the Federal Housing Administration have great market power, but we control Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and conservatorship. Significantly, the Treasury does. And so the president can take advantage of that to help assemble large concentrations of foreclosed properties and develop a new model that could assemble these homes as scattered site rental and create a viable home alternative to home ownership for families and help stabilize communities. Nira is going to talk about other ideas that illustrate the regulatory power of the president and implementing existing authority. I want to just make one last example. Is a report not mentioned in this report, but in a report that's being released as we speak. Undersecretary of Defense Ash Carter right now is part of an event where we're releasing a report entitled A $400 Billion Opportunity that showcases the opportunity the president has to use his own budget process to drive change. CAP Senior Fellow Raj Sharma describes 10 strategies to reduce the cost of federal procurements based on best practices used by the private sector. He concludes that the president can ensure that deputy secretaries lead their departments to internalize these new approaches, and OMB can use the discipline of the budget process to achieve the savings that we think are obtainable through federal procurement.
Nira?
As many know, the president has used his first 2 years in office to successfully pass landmark legislation, health care reform, financial regulatory reform, the ARRA. But legislation is only the first step of policy change. Implementation of that legislation really fulfills the promise of it and dramatically shifts decision-making authority from the Congress to the president. So in each one of the areas where the president has passed legislation and the Congress has passed legislation, he has significant decision-making authority over how it is implemented. Specifically with the health care reform legislation, we propose ensuring that there is a big prevention focus. There's a lot of authority in the legislation to provide public education, ads, et cetera, around prevention. But the president can take the new authorities from the health care reform, the Affordable Care Act, and re-emphasize prevention by ensuring there's a prevention focus across the legislative dimensions. So in the comparative effectiveness arena, he can bring up, ensure that there's prevention funding and ensuring that new strategies in prevention are understood and explored. He can look in payment reform and ensure that new payment reform methodologies are emphasizing prevention, so affordable care organizations, medical homes. So you could use all those levers to ensure that the federal government is ensuring that we are making massive improvements in prevention. That's not something that people have thought about in the Affordable Care Act, but it's a new dimension that he can explore. In terms of the new Small Business Jobs Act, which was just passed in September, that legislation is emphasizing ensuring that there's new loan authority to state small business programs. And one of the things the president can do is to ensure that he's bringing together businesses, small businesses, chambers of commerce, organizations at the local level to really to ensure that money is borrowed to really create jobs at the local level. There's a range of authorities there, but in the implementation phase, it's important for the president to ensure that these pieces of legislation are successful by demonstrating continuing work to bring people to the table to ensure they understand what money is available and that they're actually seeking loans to create those jobs that he has promised.
Thanks so much, Neera. Lynn, I believe we're ready for questions.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from Susan Page with USA Today.
John, thanks for doing this call to all of you. During the 2008 campaign, some of the people in the Obama campaign were dismissive of President Clinton's initiatives as being small ball, especially compared with big goals like overhauling health care. And I wonder, what would you say to them at this point about the idea that some of these things seem pretty minimal compared to the big goals that he came in office to do?
Well, what I would say is that history proves that if you get up and go to work every day, get into the Oval Office, pay attention to the level of details that are outlined in this report, you can make change happen. You can make progress go forward. And I think that I'm proud of my service, obviously, in the Clinton administration. I think that President Clinton proved that, and I think that the debate over the last 2 years has all been about, and which I think is actually quite natural in the early part of the presidency. It is what President Clinton did, what President Reagan did, what President Bush did, to focus on these big legislative change that you first run for office on. But now it's in the doing, it's in the execution, it's in using the terrific cabinet that he's assembled to pay attention to the each and every detail about how these policies can move forward, and to stretch beyond just the what's in the bills that he saw passed during the first 2 years of his presidency, and to think about all the authorities that rest in the legislation that gives him the power to move the country forward, that rests in his hands under the Constitution of the United States. And I think that if you think of yourself as essentially the chief executive of the government and of the country, really, and try to bring people to the table, use all the authorities that Sarah laid out, it seems to me that you're going to have a lot to show at the end of the day, and you take, in essence, the conversation away from, to some extent, a dysfunctional political conversation that we've been having in Washington, and towards one of action and of forward movement.
And can I just say one thing? This report lays out ideas that are not small bore. They are dramatic changes: lowering health care costs, reducing oil imports, ensuring the United States has a real competitiveness agenda that helps us compete in the world. These are not small bore ideas. These are big ideas. And the president can achieve progressive goals to move the country forward using these levers as well as others.
All right, great. Thank you.
Lynn, we're ready for our next question.
Your next question comes from Laura Meckler with Wall Street Journal.
Hi, guys. I got disconnected for a bit because I was on my cell phone, so if you covered this, I'll catch up on the answer later. And that is, are there a couple in particular that you think that that the administration should look to do right away for either political or policy purposes, or are you just trying to lay out the broad sweep of options?
I think the procurement report, which I mentioned, I don't know if you were on the call during that part of the discussion, is something that the president could begin implementing tomorrow. He could call all of the Presidential Management Council together, which is the deputy secretaries of all of the agencies, and say, this is a strategy which you ought to build in to your approach. And then they're in the midst of finalizing agencies' budgets, and they can build in a set of assumptions about the possibilities of savings that then will focus the mind as people begin to buy and procure the things that are important to running their agencies, to see how they can get that same business done with less. I think that the implementation of a variety of key pieces of legislation that NERA reviewed are all things that they're working on today. And what we're trying to showcase here is that those important policy choices are the president's, and that authority that he has to implement them allows him to show the public that he and his team is able to start to make things happen that matter in their lives right now when they're feeling so much pressure. There are other good examples, such as beginning to deal with the foreclosure crisis, for example, that they could do. We suggest that they empower housing counselors to make more of the choices on mortgage modifications and then make the lenders only review that, given the amazing dysfunction in the servicing of those under the HAMP program. That's a place where these changes aren't as easy as a sweep of a pen, but if they re-engineered the process, they could probably speed that process up significantly. And the president has enormous possibility to get that done.
Next question.
Your next question comes from Steve Thelma with McClatchy Newspaper.
Hi, all. John, earlier you said that the president could use this to, I think you said, to stretch beyond what's in the bills that passed. What do you say to criticism that goes beyond the separation of powers?
I'm glad you raised that, Steve, because what I was saying is he has to think beyond just the legislation he passed and think about the bills that have passed in previous administrations. So I want to clarify that. Obviously, he's constrained by the law. He can't go beyond what his inherent authority is under the Constitution, and significantly, he can't stretch beyond the laws of the United States. So thank you for catching me on that. I didn't mean to imply that he could, but I was suggesting that statutes passed in previous administrations are sources of authority. To give you an example that comes from the report, the 1990 amendments to the Clean Air Act, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, give him substantial authority to begin to move the country forward to a more clean energy future. That's not something that he worked on the Hill. In fact, his efforts were unsuccessful on the Hill, yet he retained significant authority under existing law. I think there is a real constraint that has to be observed, and I think that the lawyers in the Department of Justice and the White House would be wise to render a judgments about his authority under the laws that are restrained, if you will, that don't test the boundaries of what's constitutional or what's in the existing authorities of the statutes. But within that sweep, within that level of both constraint under the law and restraint under good judgment and wisdom, there's just very, very significant authority to push the country to a better place. I'll give you an example that I worked on during the administration of President Clinton. We preserved about 60 million acres of roadless forests. We had the authority to do that. There were policy objections coming from some people on Capitol Hill. A majority, I think, supported that effort, but it was clear that the statute permitted the Department of Agriculture to move forward and protect that land, and we did so. And I think, you know, I'm proud of the fact that we were able to do it.
Just yesterday, the administration, this is Sarah, a couple days ago, the administration announced a variety of steps on the next step on their recovery through retrofit agenda. And in that case, they created a new lending program under existing FHA authority, they call the Home Saver, to help do energy efficient retrofits to American homes using FHA financing authority. You know, that's a statute that been in place with different iterations since 1934, but it gives the FHA commissioner significant discretion to try to use that lending authority to achieve important ends that make sense in today's economy.
To both of you, why though, in both the examples you use in the Clinton years and now, both these come after the president has lost control of Congress. Why shouldn't that look like a power grab, that if you weren't going to do any of this while you had control of Congress, why shouldn't this look like an end run around Congress?
Well, I would say that the president has been doing some of this. For example, early on in the administration, I mentioned something that President Bush had done, which was to deny the state of California the right to regulate tailpipe emissions and improve auto efficiency standards. When the Obama administration came in, they grabbed a hold of that problem, work with the state of California, work with the automakers, and actually began for the first time to regulate tailpipe emission standards and raise auto efficiency standards. So they've done clearly work in this area. The agencies are out there doing some of this. I think that at some level, this White House in particular has been very preoccupied with passing legislation because the need for legislation in healthcare, in the financial regulatory arena, to get the economy going through the use of the Recovery Act authorities, etc., was a profound challenge at a time of the deep recession and the financial crisis. But I think as they digest the wins they've had legislatively, and look at the years in front of them and look at the policy agenda, particularly of the Republican House, the president's own time, the time of the White House, will essentially, this isn't a toggle switch from going from nothing to everything, but they're going to have to adjust where their attention lies. And we're suggesting it needs to be adjusted towards the use of these executive powers and authorities.
And to some extent, this is a natural evolution that happens in almost every administration, in part because it takes a while to get the teams in place. It takes a while for them to learn the authorities they have. It takes a while for them to get to know the relevant constituencies and what policy will work best for most people. And so you would see a natural ramping up of regulatory action and policy implementation in years 3 and 4 of an administration in any event. We're suggesting that many of these ideas actually are very important and don't always break through. And the president has an enormous ability to kind of lift up the ones that are going to really touch people's lives and show how change is possible.
Next question, Lynn.
Your next question comes from Michael Shearer, Time Magazine.
Hi, thanks, guys. There have been signals from some Republicans, I'm thinking of Lisa Murkowski, that if the president uses this executive authority, he will poison the well for negotiations on things like a smaller energy bill in the next Congress. What is your advice to the White House, who actually is also trying to get stuff done, whether they should consider, you know, whether too muscular executive actions might complicate legislative efforts?
Well, you know, I think that's a judgment call, and they'll have to wait and see whether there's the real ability to create compromise where there hasn't been much in the first 2 years of his presidency. But I think that doesn't mean that he could take all of these tools off the table. You said, Mike, will he give up on his ability to get something done? We think these are ideas to get something done. And in that context, I think you're going to have to judge which are the most essential to moving his agenda forward, which can wait in the hope that congressional compromise can find its way there. The president's been quite clear, I think, particularly in the area you raised, in the energy area, that his preference is obviously to try to work people in both parties on Capitol Hill to set the energy agenda for the United States. But I think if there's if at the end of another period of time then nothing's forthcoming, I think at some point the patience is not a good strategy, and he'll have to decide what's critical. There are other areas, I think, particularly in the clean energy agenda, where there should be really little or no objection. I think that the idea that a significant renewable energy can be generated at defense installations shouldn't really cause Republicans or Democrats any heartburn. It's a smart, sound strategy that's now being implemented in the private sector. It should be taken up in the public sector.
Lynn, we have time for one last question.
Okay, your next question comes from Tim Clark with Government Executive.
Thanks for the call, everybody. John, it occurs to me that Congress has the power, and indeed has threatened to use it and has used it in the past, to do two things. One is to defund or withhold funding from activities like the very significant hundreds of millions of dollars that are needed to implement the Health Care Reform Act. And secondly, it can also affect regulatory actions by inserting provisions in appropriations bills saying that no money in this bill shall be used to write X, Y, or Z climate change or whatever regulation. And so I'm wondering whether you think that those two things are a significant threat to the administration's goal of moving ahead on some of these ideas and others.
I think there's no question the Republicans have signaled, particularly in the healthcare arena, that they would like to stop implementation of the Affordable Care Act, and I think that they will try to use the power of the purse. My assumption is the House at least will try to move forward with a total repeal, and they'll have some explaining to do about why they're going back to the circumstance where you can, they'll have to throw young people off their parents' health insurance policies, and people will be denied health insurance policies for children with pre-existing conditions, etc. But I think they'll try that. When that is unsuccessful, probably be unsuccessful because it can't pass the Senate, and if it does pass the Senate, it would be vetoed, I'm certain, by the president. I think they'll go to these other strategies of trying to struggle to impede him from implementing the kinds of things that Neera talked about, like moving a preventive health care agenda forward. They have the power to try, but they don't have the power to succeed. The president has enormous capacity to resist bad ideas that he thinks are coming from the other side. It's always going to be a negotiation. Hopefully it could be one that finds legitimate and honorable compromise in some of these areas. In other places, I think there's just going to be a struggle for control and direction. But every president faces the prospect of Congress passing appropriations riders. They face the prospect of, in the old days, maybe now maybe both parties will swear off the ability of to use the appropriations bills to direct spending through earmarks. They face the capacity to to directly change policy, as I said, through riders, or to withhold funds to be able to implement policy. But if the president is willing to exercise his veto authority, and some of these fights he'll have to take to the public at large, I think there are the votes there to sustain his vetoes and to stick with the president moving this thing forward. You know, when we were the first fights after the 94 election that resulted in vetoes were environmental riders on the appropriations bills that President Clinton vetoed and ultimately, I think, prevailed on. And I think the country improved its environment as a result. And, you know, that was a constant struggle till the last appropriations bill that got negotiated. If my memory serves me right, we were sitting in the Oval Office with the Speaker and Trent Lott after Bush v. Gore, and we were still fighting about it, with 3 weeks left in the administration. So I think this will just be a struggle. It'll go back and forth. They'll win some. I think the president will win most. And I think that there's got to be some red lines, particularly his ability to go ahead and implement the health care bill that are sacrosanct and that he'll fight for with all the power that he has.
The one thing I would add is that it's clear that with the Republicans taking the House, there are more avenues to obstruct the president's agenda, both on what he wants to do and what he has done. But the big question is now that they own part of the government and governing, whether there will be more accountability for that obstruction.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Any closing comments from our speakers? I think we're set. Again, my name is Anna Solner. You can reach me at 202-492-2967. That's 202-492-2967 if you have any follow-up questions. Thanks again for joining us on the call. You can find the report at www.americanprogress.org. And there will also be a recording of this call available on the website in about half an hour. Thanks, everyone.